Books presents Schism, written and read by Bruce Elgin. This book contains mature situations, including violence and intense fight scenes. Listener discretion is advised. Prologue. You might all think that I'm going to burn this man alive because of the color of his skin, but that isn't it. Jared Smith looked down at the black man taped to the chair. The concrete floor under it was already scorched and cracked. Jared had been a guest in the city for only a few months, but it had been a busy time, and this building had already proved useful. The man in the chair didn't struggle. He simply turned his eyes from Jared to the other men standing above him. Jared watched sweat drip off the man's dark face onto the gasoline-soaked clothing. Then he turned, waited for the three newest soldiers to absorb the situation. They had all been through training, had all been tested, but this was something different for them. Here there was no distance, no anonymity or illusion about what they were doing. Here they would find out just how important their work was. Jared watched them as he went on. You might think that I'm going to kill him because he's different. That isn't it either. The three new soldiers stood next to Mike Simmons. One of them was slated to join Mike's team, a small group that they sometimes called the Cleaners. He had no doubt that young man would pass this test, but the other two were more of an unknown. He looked down at his pants, his shoes. Both were dry, and he stood well away from the rapidly evaporating stain of gasoline on the concrete. Check yourselves. Safety first. He pulled a match from the box that David Turner, his oldest friend and lieutenant, held open for him. Normally, David did the work for something like this, but the new men needed to know that Jared was able and willing to do the things that he asked of them. He waited until everyone had made sure they were dry and at a safe distance. The reason I do this isn't because he's black or because his culture is different from ours. It's because these differences are dangerous. They're dangerous because they spread. If he and his people could keep to themselves, if they could keep their culture to themselves, that would be one thing. But they don't. They all watched him, even the man in the chair, mouth taped and head moving in small shakes. They don't. Some people say that nothing he or his people do will ever add to our culture. I don't know about that. What I do believe is that they will only dilute what little we have left. They take our daughters and sisters, our cities, and our jobs. We have to fight for what we have left. Fight to get back to the way things were for us. Understand? The new soldiers nodded their heads, kept their faces grim for Jared and each other. He smiled at them and nodded back. He spun the matchstick in his fingers, held it in front of the black man. Jared didn't even know this one's name. Do you understand? The man shook his head in small, quick spasms. Jared struck the match, dropped it into the man's lap, and stepped back as the flames washed over the body. The screams, muffled until the duct tape around the man's mouth melted free, lasted for nearly 30 seconds. Sometimes it's quicker, sometimes it takes longer, Mike said. The three new soldiers nodded in understanding. None of them had flinched away. Jared held out his hand to each of them. It's an honor to serve with all of you, he said. They each shook his hand and watched the fuel burn down for a moment before leaving the room. As they did, Jared turned to the remaining men, smiled at David, his top trainer. They look good. Nice job. Not too many bad habits to drill out this time, David said. The last lieutenant, Martins, stayed quiet. Jared stood next to him, looked down at the burnt corpse. The smell was something he had never become used to, and he was grateful for that. It let him know how serious the work was. He'd just have to stay away from steak for a few days. How are we? He asked without looking up. My team's good, Mike said. Anxious for work? David nodded. I've got 35 men. The last batch has another training fire tonight. Most of them can work together pretty well. The skinheads and Nazi types were a little rough around the edges at first, but they want the job done just as much as the Klan boys do. They're a good team. Wouldn't mind more, but we can do it. Jared turned to Martins, who still hadn't spoken. He waited. Martins shrugged. Not my place to say. Yes, it is, Jared said. You're on this team for a reason. I need your opinion. It took a moment for Martins to answer. I agree with David. Clearing out the whole city with just 35 men is a lot of work. I'd be more comfortable if we called in more. Jared nodded back. But you think we can do it without the reinforcements? Yes, sir. Just wouldn't mind a little overkill, Martins said. And why should it be a small group instead of calling in more? Jared asked. He'd given them his reasons, but it was good to know which ones had stuck with them. Keeps your local contact protected. More men and it would start to look like a convention, Martin said. And it sends a message. Shows everyone in the movement just how powerful we are, how powerful they can be. If we can cleanse a city with just a handful, they can do a hell of a lot more. Jared nodded. What about supplies? David asked. I've got weapons and ammunition at the old factory, but we could still use more from that firebug of yours. That was a harder question for Jared. Their main weapon in clearing the city of any non-whites was going to be fire. The man who supplied them with bombs did good work, but Jared still wanted something more than fancy Molotovs. He was confident he could get what he needed. It would just take time. That's the second step. Jared nodded to David. First, we let the coloreds make themselves look bad. Then I'll make sure we have enough fuel for the fires. We start the big push to clean the city in 1 week. Keep the men busy until then. They each nodded back, and Jared smiled at them. Chapter 1 William Adams had always known that one day the voices would kill him. He'd been ready for that, accepted it, but he hadn't been prepared for what had happened to him over the last 2 years. He stared down at his arms, thin and pale in the plain t-shirt. It was work to fight against the haze and sluggishness that the antipsychotics caused, but he could remember how his arms had felt with more muscle than bone on them. With Jessica's hands wrapped around his biceps, he had felt strong. She had said he was handsome. But that had been 2 years ago, before she had known that he heard the voices, could see them. Even if the time in the institution hadn't melted his body away, he knew being handsome wouldn't be enough for her. The voices had to disappear. As he thought of them, whispers reached his ears, words he could almost make out. He tried to push them away, tried to block them out, but they wouldn't stop. The voices were coming back. In what felt like the last few days, but could have been weeks with the way time seemed to pass in the institution, the voices had been growing stronger, more recognizable, and he was too weak to fight them. It made him want the pills, no matter how they made him feel. He let his eyes sink down, rest on his left palm. Though he knew his hand was empty, he saw the two small pills Jessica had placed there. The first pills. He turned his wrist. They tumbled out and faded from his imagination before they could click and skitter across the floor. What was that, William? He looked up at the voice, blinked. It was the doctor, Weston. She was sitting by him in the hallway. He remembered her sitting down. It was one of the quick checkups she liked to do. You moved your arm. What were you thinking? Did you see something in your hand? He saw her gesture down to his arm. He dropped it back to his lap. He had to convince her that he didn't hear or see the voices anymore. She could let him go. She was the one who could get him back to Jess. Stretching. He focused on the arm, brought it back up for a real stretch. Why would he stretch it? It had to be convincing. I think I slept on my shoulder funny last night. You know the bed's here. His throat was tight. He spoke so rarely anymore that it hurt when he said anything. Is that all? She asked. He nodded, brought up as much of a smile as he could manage. I'm feeling very good, actually. I think we've finally found the right medications. Things are very clear. Is that so? That's good. She stood, writing notes on her pad as she did. William's eyes lagged a second behind her movements. He had to convince her. I'd like to talk again about moving to outpatient. I think I'm doing well. 2 years. He'd done it for Jess. Come in here with her. Told the doctors some of the things he did that frightened her, some of the things he heard and saw. All the while, the voices had protested, warned him not to tell. As always, they'd been right. Then the drugs had taken over. It had been 2 years since he had seen the voices or heard their directions, though he knew they were still there. But if he could convince the doctor they were gone, she'd let him go. He had done it for Jessica. She would take him back, if he could convince the doctor. Well, we'll have to see about that, won't we? Before he could answer, the doctor turned to talk to a passing nurse. He watched for a moment. Slowly, the effort of attention became too heavy and William's head sank. His face went slack as the fog boiled up around him. Its presence made the memories of Jess easier to replay. But still, he tried to push it away. Dr. Weston cut her conversation with the nurse short and took in the patient's movements before she walked to the day room. Small, yet deliberate shoving motions of the arms. Atypical for dyskinesia, she filed away a mental note to check William Adams's dosages and increase them. He wasn't getting better. His hopes of leaving were very premature. For a brief moment, she stopped and surveyed the day room. It grew quieter in her presence, which was appropriate. She noted that several patients turned their eyes away from hers, appropriate as well. it was her job to force them to confront their weaknesses and instabilities. Discomfort with her was a natural reaction to their therapy. She ended her study of the room and crossed to a young woman who sat rocking on the bleach-scented tile. "Mary, it's time for your treatment." She waited, patiently, for a short count. 1, 2, 3. The young woman rocked. Her brown hair, too long unwashed, hung in a lank veil before her eyes. "Mary, be a good girl. Give me your hand." Dr. Weston extended an arm, gently, an offer of help. She watched as Mary's rocking only deepened in response. "Mary, you don't want Henry to have to take you, do you?" She turned her eye to the orderly, noted the white shirt buttons at his bulging stomach that looked even more strained than usual. She'd have to talk with him about professional appearance. Another offer of her hand went unanswered by the girl. Dr. Weston turned her palm and laid it on the girl's shoulder. Without warning, Mary's scream hit the doctor's ears and she felt the young woman's socked foot whip out at her thigh and then again higher. The foot landed hard, just below the sternum, and drove the air out of Weston's lungs. The doctor skidded back to the floor as Henry and the other orderlies dogpiled onto Mary's thrashing limbs. One of the nurses slid to the doctor's side. "Dr. Weston, are you all right?" From her mental file, Weston placed the nurse. She was the newest on the floor, fresh out of school. Pretty. She wouldn't last long here. The doctor opened her mouth to reply, but her lungs did not respond with the necessary breath. She saw the nurse's eyes flash wide. Before her emotions could take over, Weston locked them back into place. A temporary lack of air wasn't anything she hadn't overcome before. She held up one finger in reassurance and stretched her body back on the tile. As she willed her diaphragm to unclench, her eyes took inventory of the room. Predictably, Mary's outburst had sent a ripple of tension through the patients. She would need to act immediately, or it would be a long day of separating and calming them. She felt her abdomen relax and the breath rushed in. She stood and pulled the nurse up before walking to the pile of orderlies over Mary. "It's time for her treatment. I'll be there in a moment." Dr. Weston then faced the rest of the patients in the day room. As she slowly turned, the agitated behaviors subsided, and she noted the level of calm returned to the group. Good. A flash of moving color stopped William's struggle. In the fog that surrounded him, he saw the thrashing red form of a young woman glare through the gray outlines of four men. He recognized the fellow patient, Mary, even in the swirl of color. Her arms were pinned motionless, but her body arched and twisted against the orderlies. Each bit of struggle only made the orderlies hold her tighter. William's gaze followed the procession. Red throbs flashed out of the base of Mary's skull, down her body and limbs, and then melted through her outline into the orderlies around her. The men absorbed the rage, pain, and confusion. They jerked her more roughly as they hustled down the hall. William clapped his eyes shut, tried to force the image out. The drugs weren't keeping the fog or the voices away anymore, no matter how much he wished they would. When he reopened his eyes, another woman stood before him. His vision drifted over her outline, pushed past the swirl of colors to lock onto her features. The fog began to melt away. It was the nurse. She stood over him a moment, a tentative statue with twin paper cups. "Here you are, William. Time for your pills." To William, it seemed as though the cups had a gravity of their own and pulled her arms toward him. As his hands responded, the fog boiled out from every object in his vision, every pore and crease. Around the nurse, it darkened into a storm of red and black. Tension from Mary and the doctor had poured into the nurse, and it flowed down her hands as she waited for William to respond. He kept his arm steady as he reached out to her. He had to be careful, for her sake. "Thank you," he said. Distant, tinny voices scratched at his ears. Again, William fought to ignore it, tried to hold his ground in front of the nurse. He couldn't let her know, could never let anyone know what he saw. No one believed. That was why he was at the hospital, he knew. How could anyone believe what was around them, all the time, that they could not see or hear? Things that none of them could see, and that William didn't want to see or hear ever again. "Do not take those. They are hurting you. Wake up. You need to wake up now. It is time." He recognized each of the voices, knew who they were. He turned his attention away from them as quickly as he could, afraid that if he thought about them, they would become more solid, that he would see them again. He didn't want to see them. He wouldn't get Jess back if he still saw them, heard them. William looked down. The cups were in his hands, three pills in one, water in the other. As the nurse guided the pills to William's lips, he watched wisps of crimson and black fade and bleed off her shoulders. which slowly relaxed as he did what she asked. She was starting to calm down. He had hid it from her, hadn't shown her what he could see. "That's good. Swallow now," she said. The pills tumbled into his mouth, and the nurse nudged the waxy paper of the water cup to his lips. Tilted. "Stop." It was a man's voice, almost a growl. "They're making you sick." A woman this time, her tone filled with worry and compassion. "You need to be ready." The final one, a deep and calm man's voice. All three of them were back. How could he fight them away like this? The pills had made him too weak. William let the stale water glide to the back of his mouth and did his best to swallow. The nurse smiled at him. "That's good, William. You just rest there. We'll take you to your room soon." Henry's hand at his elbow, William was ushered into the blank-walled room into the metal-framed single bed. They stopped before it. "What's it gonna be, man? Side or back?" William stared down at the white sheets, kept a tight focus on the individual threads, on each yellowed stain. Henry grumbled. "Side it is." The orderly's hands performed the choreography automatically. Turn, push, swing, roll. The routine was over and William faced the sidewall. He switched his focus to divots in the patched plaster. The light dimmed with a squeaking turn of the shades under Henry's fingers, and William was alone. He focused everything he could into the plaster, tried to keep the world solid as the edges of the small patches began to smooth and disappear. William stole energy from every muscle, his legs, back, arms, and neck, to feed his concentration, to shove the fog away. But it closed in over his vision, too thick to push through. The voices were growing strong again, louder than before. His mouth slackened. The voices wanted him, and he didn't have the strength to resist. Three quiet plops echoed through the growing fog into William's ears, soft splatters of pills onto thin cotton sheets. The wall began to melt and swirl before him, and William clenched eyes shut against it, retreated into memory. He had been handsome once, and she had been beautiful. More than that, William could feel her warmth, her love, as she wrapped her hands around his arm. He squinted against the sun and saw the smile crinkle the corners of her eyes behind her dark glasses. She pulled him in close as they walked down the sidewalk, and William smiled. The fog pulled William back from the memory. It was dark outside, but the fog that filled the room made it seem brighter. He saw that the fog was thicker and was starting to swirl into recognizable human shapes. William rolled away from the figures of the three voices. "You have to leave. Watch. Look." He turned back and the fog slid into a dense cloud, formed a frame in the air, and William couldn't keep his eyes from staring into its center. Within the frame, William could see through the wall into the outside hallway. Dr. Weston was walking down it. Her red hair was pulled back tightly, its tint muted amidst the tangle of colors that swirled within her. Attention locked on the doctor, William sat up in bed. As he focused on the moving frame and the doctor's progress down the hall, the fog grew more dense around him. In it, three figures took on more solidity than they had had in years, since he first took the drugs. William's eyes sagged at each recognition. They had been helpers once. Now he knew what they had cost him, and that he would have done anything to never see or hear them again. A male figure, tall and lanky, towered in a corner of the room, the advisor. A quick-moving, muscular man took shape nearby. The hunter paced from wall to wall, like a large cat in too small a cage. The caretaker's feminine shadow blew together at the side of the bed, an arm out to soothe William. He ducked away from it, turned from the frame as long as he could, but the pull of the voices drew his eyes back to what they wanted him to see. The doctor passed into a room, and the frame followed her to show Mary secured to a bed. "Help her, she needs you." The caretaker moved closer to him. The hunter paced through the door and back. "Now." "Before it is too late," the advisor said. Every muscle in his weakened body unwilling, William rose and shuffled to the door. Dr. Weston watched the young patient nod in response to her question. The movement was stilted, disconnected, the head rising before coming down. But it was a response. The appropriate response. "You'll be a good girl now, yes?" Another forced nod from Mary, her eyes closed, breath rhythmic. Weston didn't need to check Mary's records to know that the young woman would require a great deal of rest. With sedation, muscle relaxants, and the normal side effects of tiredness from electroconvulsive therapy, Mary wouldn't wake until tomorrow. She didn't like having to visit Mary like this, especially when the young woman was so unresponsive. But she knew it was the best time to remind Mary that such bad behavior would not be tolerated. Her left hand reached out, stroked a strand of Mary's hair away from her face. Hush. Quiet now. Behind her, the door inched open. William came in and silently shut the door behind him. This is author Bruce Elgin. Thank you for listening to the prologue in Chapter 1 of Schism. Please stay tuned for Chapters 2 and 3.